Our next speaker today is Steve Morissette, who's going to be looking at things from a little different point of view, from the intellectual property point of view. So, Steve, all yours. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me? At the symposium last year, they had a politician who talked as kind of the intellectual relief, shall we call it, from all the scientific stuff. This year, I have a suspicion that with the name healthcare in the title, that no politician was willing to come within a mile of this auditorium. So Larry asked me to provide the intellectual relief instead. My name is Steve Morissette, and I'm a lawyer. And so I am not going to talk about science in any sort of sophisticated way. I'm going to talk about it from the point of view of a lawyer who presents, who has to certainly impress his clients, but more importantly has to be able to present cases to the judge and jury. And as a lawyer, my style of presenting the truth and finding the truth is somewhat different than a scientist. A scientist, as I view it, sees the truth like the pot at the end of the rainbow. And you see the rainbow, you know there's a pot there, and you go toward it, and you find things, and you never get to the end of it. I think healthcare in the last 200 years has been incredible. We have discovered so many things, not me, but others, and yet we still haven't found the pot of gold, and we're still searching. My job, on the other hand, is to, I would compare it, if we were to look at, say, television programs, science is like The Wire. You have an hour program, you get to the end of it, but then you know that it's going to get much more complicated in the next episode, and everything builds, and they're going to have another episode. My profession, it's more like a 30-minute sitcom. At the end of the 30 minutes, it's over, you have everything resolved, and that's the truth, and that's it. So what I need to do when I'm presenting, and I'm going to do this for you, is I need to make sure that I create a good first impression, and I need to have physical exhibits. So I brought some physical exhibits that I'm going to use in my presentation. This is a patent, okay? You'll notice it has a ribbon, and this is something officially issued by the U.S. Patent Office. I'm presenting these to you now because I want you to kind of anticipate that these will be used during the course of my presentation. Then I have a couple of other physical exhibits. Okay, these are dolls. And I'm not going to tell you right now how they're going to be used, but they will be used in the exhibit later on. And the clever of you among the audience may actually figure out what they have to do with my presentation. So let's talk about patents and healthcare. I'd like to start out, make sure we're all on the same page. Why patents? I think that, you know, we all know what patents are in general sense, but I think most of us don't really think about it, and I spend a lot of time thinking about it, of course. But patents originally were not designed to give you protection for little tiny improvements so that you could extend the life of your pill for another 20 years by coming up with an extension on the patent. What patents were originally designed to do is they were designed to protect new manufacturers. They actually were anti-monopoly. They were designed so that if you had a new product that you were going to put on the market, something that no one else was doing, you could get protection. And if it competed with someone else, you didn't have a right to a patent. So it had to be something new and different. And what happened was the Queen Elizabeth I was one of the first people who actually made money off of this. The Crown made a big amount of money on it, and they discovered that patents were so profitable that they gradually expanded them. By the time of the Industrial Revolution, they had changed the concept of patents. Why just limit it to new things? We can make a lot more money on the royalties, we can make a lot more money on the patents if we allow patents on any sort of improvements. And so patents, the whole purpose of patents was changed from the idea of a grant of just on new things to a grant of rights to exclusive use in exchange for disclosing your particular secrets. So in other words, the inventor, rather than keep it as a trade secret, would disclose it to the public, and the government would provide for protection, essentially a monopoly, for a limited period of time. And we adopted that. That came into England in the 18th century, 1700s, and then we adopted that into the U.S. Constitution. So patents are a constitutional right, just like guns. anyway, the specific statute is in 35 U.S.C., and it says whoever invents or discovers any new and useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, or any useful improvement thereof, is entitled to a patent. Okay, and some of those are going to be more important in the healthcare and the pharma industry than others. But let's go through it. I mean, it's incredible if you think about all of the areas that people can get patents in. You basically cannot walk into the doctor's office without having, assuming that they haven't been licensed, infringing probably a dozen or more patents. They're patents on pharmaceuticals. They're patents on chemical compositions. They're patents on medical devices, the machinery, synthesized materials, whether it's genetic materials or other materials, diagnostic testing, medical treatments, surgical procedures. I've got a few pictures up here. By the way, that's an old cranial skull drill there. for those who wonder what it is, it's not a corkscrew. The result of having this patent system in place in science and commerce is that we have to somehow combine all of these different fields in a way that's going to work together. They all have to work together. We've got the science, we've got the need to make money, and then we have the law. That's my role. What happens is, though, we end up with a need to regulate all this stuff, and that's where this gets managed by government. Okay, so we have all of these competing, working together interests being managed by the U.S. government, which is now known as the Patent and Trademark Office. It has 10,000 employees. I've got some other figures there. It's got this huge operation. And right now, in modern times, we have almost 500,000 patent applications filed a year. We have a current backlog of almost 750,000 patents. And we have a huge delay that's happening because this is a government bureaucracy and it's all of this is going on simultaneously. So what we have is what I've referred to as a curious collision of things moving together. This is an old article out of the 1887 where a couple of trains collided when they were traveling in the same direction. But that's what we've got. We've got everybody's trying to work together, but we've got some things that are happening that don't seem to work quite the way that you would plan on, and certainly not the way Queen Elizabeth I thought it was going to work when she first allowed patents to be created. So what we've got, I want to just go through a few of these because I think that, you know, if I gave you some of the other patents that are related, but this what I really like. This was a real live patent in 1965, and I think the thing that, you know, that I need to point out to you that this is actually a very, very clever patent, because when the baby's born, now for those of you who don't understand this picture, she's actually spinning on a centrifuge in the doctor's office, and this is the way that she's going to give birth. It's going to give a little bit of extra help. But when the baby's born, it drops into that net, and there's actually a switch down below that turns off the centrifuge. 1965. It gets worse. Here's a life expectancy timepiece. This was issued in 1991. you could put this on you, and it will tell you, using actuarial tables, when you're going to die. Okay. Now we're going to move a little bit away from those were the health science ones. We're going to move a little away from that. This is one that I found truly amazing. This is issued in 1999. A fashion shopping method: receiving the customer information, selecting the clothing from an inventory the customer chooses from the selection, and you place the order. That got patented. Okay. Here's one that's is a little bit more scientific. It's a hyper light speed antenna. If you have this actually made a little bit of the news when it came out. This is a way of communicating faster than the speed of light. And the way it does it, I'm only going to summarize here because, you know, it's really complicated. But essentially it puts the communication into an injection point into the third dimension and manages to go through, and this was issued by the patent office. Okay. So let's and then finally one more. The animal methane emissions. What you could see that cows actually produce a lot of methane. And this was indicated, this was actually issued in 2006 as a solution for global warming. All right, but it goes on. I mean, we have these applications are in the pipeline. The patent office is looking at these right now. This is one And this is the one that, you know, I want to be a little bit more serious here because this is a serious concern. This is a method for treating binge eating disorder. And they are trying to get a patent on the idea of diagnosing a patient, or patient, I'm sorry, as having the eating disorder, providing an effective amount of amphetamine prodrug, and then either as its only active agent or with other active agents, supplying it. Now, the problem with things like this is if they get through, you end up with what I think are really bad patents. So here's another one. This one is a system for healthcare claims processing. And this is a method patent, receiving the request to submit medical invoice to the payer, acquiring the files from electronic medical records, displaying the name of the files, and then if the user, meaning you know your patient, approves, electronically sending it to the payer. And I'm wondering how many healthcare professionals have not or would not infringe this patent by sending their bills off to the insurer. And this is a patent that was filed in 2007 and is currently pending, has not been rejected. So let's talk about a little bit about what patents are. The purpose of patents is to provide for new and useful inventions. And what the patent office has done, what the Congress has done, the patent office has done, is come up with a bunch of elaborate regulations. And I'm going to go through some of them with you, not because I want you to remember them. And those of you who actually know these regulations will recognize that I'm giving very short shrift to them. I mean, they actually have a lot more to them than what I'm going to talk about. But it's important for you to understand, when you're thinking about patents, that there are some rules on what can be patented and something the patent office is supposed to do. First of all, the one that actually I'll talk a little bit more about later with respect to the Myriad Genetics case is patentable subject matter. We mentioned process, machine, manufacture, composition. Things that are not patentable are laws of nature, physical phenomena, and abstract ideas. There are cases on this that have been decided by the U.S. Supreme Court that essentially try to define that down. And the early one that I have is the Funk Brothers, which simply says that it has to be something that's non-natural. And the common phrase that you may have heard is anything under the sun made by man. The recent case, which just came down in 2010, last year, Bilski versus Kappos, our firm argued on the losing side, but we were happy that the court didn't totally reject the idea of business method patents. It was a 5-4 decision over the issue of business method patents. Some of these crazy patents that have managed to get through in the last decade have caused the U.S. Supreme Court to wonder what the heck is going on in the patent office. And so the four minority were actually in favor of getting rid of business method patents, and the question is whether that might actually, if they were to become the majority, it might also get rid of software patents, the sort of thing that there are a lot of patents now. So anyway, what it did was it essentially said that you can still get patents on a wide variety of things, but in this particular case, you couldn't get a patent on the investing on an investment strategy. It involved hedging your losses in the energy industry by investing in other types of energy. So okay, we'll just go through a few of these. Obviousness is a, just a minute here. Obviousness is a very important factor. A recent Supreme Court case again came back and tried to set the record straight and say that obviousness means something that a person of ordinary skill in the art would know, and it has been clarified that it is obvious even if you can't find it in a written record, even if you can't find it in a published patent or you can't find it in an article. If a scientist who practices the industry would go, duh, that's obvious, okay? The recent case, the problem with a standard like that, that's the U.S. Supreme Court says, you know, we don't want to set a bright line rule. We want the duh rule. If the scientist says duh, that is the standard. The problem with that is that then it gets interpreted by the courts. And in the case of In re Kubin, which is a recent case, came out 2 years ago, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals that hears all patent appeals looked at a case in which they were sequencing a human gene and said it's not patentable. And the reason they said it's not patentable is because you are doing something that is from a known set of options. You've got a certain number of genes that you can look at, and if it's at all predictable, if it's obvious to try, then we're not going to allow it patent. And the problem with the language, I'm not going to get into the details of that, but the language in that suggests that if you have a finite quantity of tests that you can run, it might not be patentable. Now, I don't think that's the right interpretation for that, but that's a whole separate topic. Written description is another separate requirement for patents. If you don't put a proper, complete written description, even if it's obvious to the scientists who would be reading it, if you don't have it described in your patent, you don't get, and even if you've claimed it, you don't get patent protection. So the most recent case on this is Centocor Ortho versus Abbott Labs, in which the claim was to antibodies to human immune cell protein. It was the TNF-alpha. And the patent disclosed a mouse antibody. And the court said, even though your mouse antibody, a scientist might recognize that that could be used for a, and you've clearly claimed the human protein, you don't have coverage because you don't have a written description of a human protein. You lose. Enablement is a separate requirement from written description. Enablement says that in the, and by the way, these are, the language is in the statute, but these are all court-created rules to try to control who gets a patent and who isn't. The enablement requirement is different than written description. Enablement, written description says you have to actually describe it. You can't, the scientist who reads it can't assume it. You have to actually describe it. Enablement says you have to provide a sufficient description of how to do it so that a scientist would know how to do it. And the problem there is how much do you include? If you don't include enough, the question may be whether or not you have provided, if you're going, for instance, for a whole genus of a compound, whether you've provided enough to get the entire genus or whether you just get the specific compounds you've disclosed in the patent, even if you've claimed more broadly. Best mode is another requirement. This is unique to the United States. If you have basically a method for making your particular compound or your particular product that is not disclosed in the patent, even though you provide a description, even though you have enablement, everybody knows how to do it, even though your claims clearly require it, you withheld the best mode, you can also lose your patent. Doctrine of equivalence is another principle created by the courts that actually broadens the rights that you have under patents. It says that even if you didn't describe it, and you might say, well, doesn't this sound like it's a conflict? Well, contradiction to the others I just told you about? Yep, it is. Okay, but if you don't exactly describe it, if it does exactly the same thing in the same way and with the same result, if there's an insubstantial, that's the old standard, if there's an insubstantial difference from each of the claim elements, that you may still be able to get patent protection. And then finally, we have rules that say that the courts are going to look at the patent and read the claims, and the judges are going to be the ones who decide how to construe those claims. Now, the problem is that we're using the English language in the patent, and we're using the English language that came from the scientist or the engineer who then went and talked to his patent attorney, and the patent attorney said, okay, well, let's try to draft that up. And then they went and they drafted up a specification that went on for pages, and they edited it. And then they took it to the patent office, and the examiner, who's hopefully has, you know, at least a BS degree in whatever the relevant science is looking at this thing that some PhD scientist did and says, well, I don't get it, so you modify that. And by the time you get through, what you have is something maybe different than what you intended. I like the quote from this consultant, a patent agent will never call a spade, if they can call it a substantially planar, earth-moving implement with coaxial leveraging means. And then a Bertrand Russell quote, everything is vague to a degree you do not realize until you have tried to make it precise. That's what writing patents is about. Okay, and finally, one catch-all that we tend to throw into our cases is a fraud on the patent office. All of these other things aside, if you actually intentionally submit something that's false or you intentionally withhold something that's material, you can lose your patent rights. And a recent case on that, it was a Monsanto versus Bayer case. This was a patent on chimeric genes, and Bayer failed to disclose some notes in one of its engineering notes that directly contradicted an argument. Now, here you've got the engineers who are talking to the patent attorney, and then the patent attorney goes in and talks to the examiner. And the engineer's got some notes. And the patent attorney who goes into the examiner may or may not know what are in those notes. He may not have asked to get a complete copy of them. He goes in and he argues, oh, no, we never intended that. And the notes said something different. The court said, tough, you lose your patent. It's invalid, unenforceable. So if you get nothing out of what I'm talking about today, what I'd like to do is have you look at my knowledge pyramid here. Now, somebody else has coined knowledge pyramid. I'm not talking about their knowledge pyramid. I could have called it the power pyramid, but I think somebody's coined that too. So, but anyway, the knowledge pyramid is this, that what when you have an invention, and I'm talking about not one of those bad ones that I showed you at the beginning, but a legitimate good invention, at this point in society, after 100 years of development, it probably is a fairly sophisticated thing. It may have involved PhDs working for months or years. It may involve a lot of research. And that information is in the heads of some very bright people. That information has to get conveyed, possibly, and then I've got technicians down, because a lot of times the idea may have been implemented by people who actually spent the time in the lab and did all the work. That information all has to get conveyed to a patent attorney who has to write this stuff up, has to put it into a patent application, has to go to the PTO examiner. The examiner then has to understand it well enough, and of course the examiner then has to compare it with what else is out there. And then you get a patent that's issued if the PTO agrees. And what happens is that just sits there until there is a dispute. And if there is a dispute, you can certainly negotiate with the other party as to whether or not you think their patent is you're infringing their patent, or whether they're infringing your patent. But if the dispute goes to trial, a case gets filed, and the next level down, and this is the level I'm at. This is kind of the semi-dumb level. Less knowledgeable level is the trial attorney. And the trial attorney has the job of doing nothing more than trying to make enough sense out of what all these other really bright people did to explain it to the two lowest people on the totem pole. The only problem with those two lowest people on the totem pole is they're the ones who are going to make the decision. So you have to actually take what the scientists have done and convert it into something that this judge is going to understand. And the judge is then going to pass it on to the jury with jury instructions, which usually are 100 pages long, that say to the jury, listen to what these people say and decide whether or not this patent is valid and whether or not this particular product infringes this particular patent claim. Okay, so let's talk about why this is a better deal than we had before. Historically, we had trial by ordeal. And the trial by ordeal principle was that God would decide. And I've got a picture of one here. There actually was trial by fire, of course, and there was trial by water. What many people don't realize, that trial by water went two different directions. For a while, they actually had trial by water was if you drown, then you're innocent. If you float, you know, you're guilty. Well, that didn't work very well because, obviously, the innocent people all died. The guilty people, of course, got burned at the stake or something. They also did try the approach of if you managed to survive somehow, meant you were innocent. So that was an approach. Okay, so next approach was wager of by battle, trial by combat. The strongest man will win. And, this, to some degree, prevailed into duels in the relatively recent time. Another one was wager of law, which was essentially if you could get 12 people to all swear that you were right, you win. I kind of like that. That's getting closer to a jury. But in the 12th century, in the 1100s, they first brought in juries. And the idea of a jury originally was, as many of you probably know, it was people familiar with what the case was. And then by the 14th century, it became, we want people who know absolutely nothing about the case. And everybody thought that was such a great idea. That's what we've kept today. We want a jury that knows as little as possible about anything that's going to be tried in this case. So what happens is, we've got in a patent case, there's a right, an absolute right, to a jury trial, because a patent is a tort, and we have a right to jury trial under the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution, and we have a right to patents under the Constitution. So in most cases, we have a right to a jury trial, so that's what you're going to get. Now, there is one exception, or there are several exceptions, in ANDA cases under the Hatch-Waxman Act. You don't get a jury trial, you get a bench trial. That's really a good thing, because it means, in theory, you're going to have a judge who sits there, but the problem is the judge is not much better trained than the jury, so you're going to be, to some degree, dependent on whether or not you've got a competent judge. There are other situations where you don't have a jury trial, but the other thing I want to talk about is, since I want to explain why this is even more of a problem, is that because patent cases have become so popular, because they are big money makers, We now have about 3,000 patent cases filed a year. And even though only 4% of them go to trial, it's still a lot that go to trial. The number of cases that this was just one day's case that came across my desk. We got a list of all of these so we can try to look at cases. But those are cases that came across in one particular day, and that probably was a higher day. But now I want to talk a little bit about what we as trial lawyers and what you if you've got a patent that you need to think about. Who is your audience when we're actually going to present this? Because we've got all of these great ideas, we've got this protection, or you're on the other side, you're trying to defend. And I'm not trying to suggest anything. This is a picture. Oh, okay. This must have been with the mad cow disease. Anyway, we have a choice. We have the federal judges, and we have the federal juries, because a patent case has to go to federal court. And the federal judges, we've got a lot of judges to choose from, over 600 judges. Unfortunately, none of them are trained in patent law, and almost none of them have any science education. There are some that are very bright and some of them that are very good, and there are a lot that really hate patent cases. If you go in front of a jury, you're almost guaranteed to have a jury pool who knows absolutely nothing about science. If there's anybody who gets onto that jury pool who knows anything about the technology, one side or the other is certain to knock them off. And so you are going to have housewives, retired people, and on our last trial, we've a horse lover who hated being there, period. And that's what you're going to have as in terms of making the decision. Now, I don't mean to say that they're not sincere and they're not interested in the right result. It's just that they don't know anything, and that's who's going to be deciding this. So to help us out in the patent industry, we have a whole bunch of experts. We've got expert witnesses who come in. I know Dr. Gold has done that before. And we have expert witness finders. We actually have people that will help us find the experts. We have litigation consultants at all their different levels, to the trial level, help get discovery, help find things. We have prior art searches. We create graphics. My graphics were my own. I'm sorry I didn't go out and hire somebody. There are patent brokers that are involved, because one of the things you want to do is if you decide you want to go after your competitor and you don't really like your patents that much or they're going after you, is you go out and look for other people's patents, and you buy other people's patents, and you do that. And so there's a booming industry now in patents buying and selling, and then industry analysts at all sorts of levels. The problem is that litigation has gotten expensive, and I want to talk a little bit about the consequences, the unintended consequences of the patent law, because it can cost $5 to $10 million to try a complicated pharma case. Or a complicated case involving high medical technology, it becomes a weapon to extract settlements. It becomes essentially a force in and of itself that has nothing to do with the rights and protection and innovation and all that kind of stuff. The damages exposure is huge. My next slide is going to show that. And then finally, the uncertainty, the no guarantee of success. What I tell clients, I may secretly believe we've got a better chance, but a slam dunk is 70-30, because you're going in front of a jury. Now, I will say that my view of juries is I think that they're 80% right. Okay, that's still 20% wrong. And I'm very happy with the jury we had last time, because they were right. They voted my way. Okay, so the problem is we're depending on, since we don't have knowledge, we're depending on intuition and understanding of the jury or the judge. And the reversal rate is very high. So, I just put up on the screen here a few of the big cases that have come down, medical industry type cases. These are the kinds of exposures that a company that decides to go to trial is looking at. And unless you are essentially a huge company with a huge deep pocket, any of these kinds of verdicts are bet the farm. If you lose the case on either side, it can be the end of the company. And so that is one of the big problems that we have. And the problem, and this is where my exhibits come into play here. One of the recent cases, it was not a patent case, but the problem is it's so uncertain. Maybe some of you have heard there have been a big fight between Mattel and MGA. MGA is the company that makes the Bratz doll, and Mattel is the company that makes the Barbie doll. Thank you. And what happened was there was a Mattel employee that went to work for MGA, and Mattel said they took the idea of the Bratz doll, and Bratz back in the early 2000s made a huge amount of money, and Mattel took the case to trial, and the first jury awarded $100 million. We're talking dolls here. We're not talking about pills that are saving people's lives. We're not talking about new techniques for diagnosis or anything like that. We're talking about dolls. We're talking about toys. $100 million to Mattel, and took it all away from MGA. They're out of business. Of course, they appealed. The appellate court reversed it, and it went back to trial in front of a second jury. In April, just 3 weeks ago, the second jury came back and awarded $88 million to the Bratz Company. Now, admittedly, there were different facts in the case, but this involved trade secrets and involved copyright, because you really can't get a patent on dolls. I mean, dolls have been around for a while. But the fact is that this is such a risky situation, because you are depending on the quality of your fact finder, and you're depending on a whole bunch of other things that you don't have any control over. And to me, that's a problem. I mean, that's a problem. It doesn't mean that patents aren't a good thing, but it does mean our system is exposed. So let's talk about a few solutions. And you can let me know whether you like any of these solutions or not. But these are solutions that are in progress right now. One is that has is currently in the works is patent reform. Patent reform essentially is the idea of, okay, well, we've had our Patent Act around for, I think it's since 1952 now. It's been around a long time. Let's change it around. And let me just mention before I get to patent reform. There was a previous patent reform effort that was done in 1984, which was included in the provisions for handling drugs. The Hatch-Waxman Act provided for a method for dealing with ANDA litigation, and many of you may be familiar with this, but I just want to mention it briefly, because it was another case of where the legislature decided to do patent reform, and not everybody agrees that it was a great idea, although I think it's got some good points. The idea was that the pharma companies that have the patents are holding on to them too long, so let's give the generics an opportunity to get in earlier. And so generics, for any number of reasons, the most common one is to simply challenge an existing patent. They can come in and essentially file an ANDA application, filing with the FDA, and give notice to the patent company. And the pharma company has 45 days to sue the generic, or else the generic gets to start selling the product. So essentially, it's a way that the generic, without ever actively infringing, can force the patent owner to file suit. And so you have these cases that get filed with the idea that it will get the generic cheaper drug on the market without the huge risk, without those huge exposures of $100 million, because there's no damages, because there hasn't been any infringing products yet sold. It's a bench trial, so you don't have to worry about a jury. And the problem is that what you now have is you have a situation where pretty much every major drug gets challenged by the generics. Of the 50 top drugs now, over 40 have been challenged in an ANDA litigation. And so what happens is it becomes very expensive, and the companies, to figure out a solution to this, have come up with what's called the reverse payments, which is the generic sues the pharma company, and the pharma company says, you know, what about if we simply pay you money and you just go away? Okay. And so the deal is we'll pay you some money just not to make the product. And of course, the Federal Trade Commission sees this as an antitrust violation. But at this point, the courts have not agreed. I mean, the problem is here you've got a patent reform solution that, you know, doesn't necessarily always work. But it's maybe better than not having the solution. So let's talk about what is currently in the works. And this isn't worth spending a lot of time because it's still a bill, but it has been adopted by the Senate, and the House has shown an interest in passing this. Just as a back note, this patent reform concept has been around probably for six or more years, and every time it comes up, you know, it gets killed by all of the conflicting interests. There's a huge conflict between the biotech interest in patents and the electrical interest in patents. Biotech looks at a lifetime that, you know, is a longer time. And electrical, you know, 6 months is, you know, you're on to the next iPhone. So there, and there are a lot of other conflicts. And so what happened was this last fall, when this is a third-hand story, is when President Obama was out in California collecting money for campaign donations, he met with a couple of the top bio folks and a couple of the top electrical folks and said, look, you know, why don't you guys work something out? Because you both agree we need patent reform. And so that's why this bill is in the works right now, because there was a kind of a compromise that's behind the scenes. So one of the most important things that it's doing, which is worth knowing because I think this will happen, is it changes from a first to invent to a first to file system, which means that it's a first inventor to file. It means the first company or the first individual who gets the patent filed is the one who's going to get it. And that what a first inventor to file means is that you can't just do this if you're not the inventor. You have to be the inventor. But it's no longer, you can't go say that I conceived of this and I've been working on it for years in my lab. It's now going to be a rule that says whoever gets to the patent office first. The idea is to speed things up, and this is the same system that they use in all the rest of the United States. A few other things. It adds, because of all of the problems with the PTO, it provide and with the sufficiency of the patents, it provides for new mechanisms for reviewing patents. There's going to be a post-grant review instead of having a patent just issued and that's it. There will be a brand new post-grant review process in addition to the re-exam process and some other things that I won't go through. So there are just some new protections that are being built into the bill. I think they're probably good. It does another thing that I don't know whether has been that big an issue for any of the people in the room, but false marking has taken off as a big new way for plaintiffs' attorneys to make money. If you can find a package that still has an old patent number on it, you sue the drug company and say you're falsely marking your package. And they're going through and basically every single package is being searched by plaintiff's attorneys now. And so this would eliminate the ability for plaintiff's attorneys to come in and do that. I want to talk a little bit about Myriad Genetics. We talked about the fact that there is a subject matter jurisdiction requirement. This is a case that has made the news recently because it involves, I think, a very sensitive topic, which is the right of women to be diagnosed correctly for breast cancer. There was great information available on the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes showing that they're associated with breast cancer. The unfortunate thing from the point of view is that of patients and of researchers is that Myriad is charging more than many people would like. It's, I think somebody quoted $3,500, but No, it's at least over $3,000 a test. And this is a patent that covers more than one thing. It covers the isolated genes, and it also covers the use of the genes as a probe or a primer. And the issue here, which is one that creates a lot of heat, is whether or not an isolated, purified DNA molecule is subject matter. And what the district court did was it held that because it's products of nature, it's not patentable. You can't patent it. And that the methods were simply directed to the abstract steps of looking at the genes and not patentable. It's currently in front of the Federal Circuit. It's been fully briefed. The Federal Circuit's probably going to decide this case in the next month or so. Myriad's view is, I think, very straightforward, which is that these are not products of nature. They're isolated, purified genes. They're functionally different. We're not talking about DNA. We're talking about cDNA. So it is something that is created. The researcher ACLU point of view is that they are products of nature. What's interesting is that the PTO has issued patents for genes for years. The U.S. government has uniformly backed it up until this last time, and the U.S. government now has taken a different position. They're not supporting the PTO on this. They're taking the position that if it is isolated without further alteration, it's not protectable. If it's isolated with changes, then it is protectable. So they've taken an intermediate ground on this. I want to talk about a couple of other, before I end, a couple of other programs that I think are designed to try to improve the system. One is a patent pilot program, having specialized judges. This is on a volunteer basis. It would be on a 10-year trial, and this is another current administration proposal. We would have judges who volunteer, essentially. They wouldn't necessarily be trained in the law or in science, but they would be available to handle patent cases, and we would develop a specialized expertise. And the other is that I don't know whether any of you have participated or heard in, is basically what's called the Patent Peer Program. It's a program in which people are put in information to the patent office while the patent application's in progress, and provide information about whether the patent ought to be issued. There was a previous pilot program, and the current one involves biotechnology, bioinformatics patents, but this program is only for applicants who volunteer. In other words, the applicant has to agree to have the peer review of the patents. I think it would be better if there was a program where the rest of us could put in our 2 cents for it. So in essence, we don't know whether we've got a good enough solution. Jury's still out. And I thank you.
We'll just take a question or two if we could, because I know the it's getting late and we still have to one right over here. Hold on. Let's get your microphone if we could.
Thank you. You mentioned the genetic material as being composition of matter. Is that what you said?
Yes.
So I think there was a case where there was a couple of patients who had the HIV virus, but yet they didn't convert, or they carried the virus, but they didn't convert to AIDS. And so if your genetic material is different enough, or there's something unique about it, and you're able to discover something. So this, the reason I ask this is I do clinical research, and I collect samples from patients, hundreds of patients. And the biotech companies and the pharma will make a discovery from that patient's blood and that patient's genetic material. So doesn't the patient have the right to have their genetic material be, I mean, if there's something unique about it, is it not different?
Well, I think that's part of what this whole issue is that the apparent objection is that you shouldn't be allowed to simply patent genetic material that's part of somebody else's body. There's a it's almost a moral issue as much as it is a legal issue. And can you patent that information because you happen to be the scientist who collected that, say from a group of, you know, if you're doing a study and you collect a bunch of information, can you then claim to have the right to that particular genetic material from that person? You discover that and tell the person that they cannot get treatment for it because you have a patent on what you learned from their material. I think that's a big problem, and I think the answer is going to be something along the lines of that they're entitled to protection for the methods that they develop for the therapeutics or the diagnostics for doing it, but they're not entitled to the material. So you're entitled to use your material in other ways. I think that's probably what it's going to come down to.
So a patient can't patent their own genetics. Like before these people go and sequence their genome, they can't patent it first.
I don't see how they could.
Right.
By the way, there's another issue here, and that is that sequencing is now so basic. I mean, somebody's even referred to as even high school students now do it. That I don't know if that's true or not. That another issue is here is are these patents obvious now? Whereas they might have been patentable 10 years ago, maybe some of these patents are no longer patentable, not because of subject matter, but because of obviousness. That'll still be trial by jury. It simply would be judges that would specialize in doing this. No, No, that's a big problem.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.